first recorded last November, we'll meet a wealthy publisher-financier so taken with the music of Gustav Mahler that at the age of 42 he hired a conductor to teach him conducting and rented an orchestra to make his debut leading Mahler's Resurrection Symphony, something he has since been invited to do more than 50 times. His name is Gilbert Kaplan, and his CD of Mahler's Symphony No. 2 is the best-selling Mahler work of all time. How did he do it? Why did he do it? To what lengths did he go in following his passion? And how does the music world regard him? We'll meet Gilbert Kaplan in a moment, and to help us get answers to those questions, I'll be joined by Michael Shavelson, executive editor of Bostonia and the BU Bridge, who writes regularly about classical music. But first, let us listen to the opening of the symphony that in some fundamental way transformed Gilbert Kaplan and audiences the world over. We've been listening to the opening moments of Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 2, known as The Resurrection, and that performance was by the London Symphony Orchestra under the direction of Gilbert Kaplan, who is my guest tonight on Boston University's World of Ideas, along with Michael Shavelson, who's executive editor of Bostonia. Gentlemen, thank you both for joining me tonight. Before we talk specifically about Mahler and his music, we really need to know some more about you, Gilbert. I understand that you were not a professional conductor by training from small on, as are most of them. What is it about Gustav Mahler that made you turn, in a sense, from finance and publishing to conducting?
It's a question I've obviously thought about for a long time, and I must say I've never been able to answer it successfully. I know I had what I would call an encounter when I was 25 years old, when a friend took me to a rehearsal of the American Symphony playing this work at Carnegie Hall, and I felt an emotional connection with the music I had never felt with music before. It's as simple as that, if that's simple. I knew the repertory rather well. I had not yet heard Mahler's music. I had studied the piano only for 3 years, age 7 to 10, and then a little bit more later, but I was certainly not a trained musician.
And that was a performance and rehearsal conducted by Stokowski, is that right?
Yes.
And suddenly, it struck you in a way that no other piece of music had. You're traveling the world now, conducting only this piece.
Well, after I heard the piece the first time, I realized that I probably had a reaction to it which I never would explain. And over the years, I would listen to performances. It wasn't performed so often. I listened to recordings. And around when I turned 40, no midlife crisis, the thought occurred to me that I might unlock this mystery as to why I had this connection with the music by trying to conduct it myself. I would be the first to admit a rather foolish idea. But I did spend a year working with a young conductor from Juilliard, averaging 5 hours a day, every day for about 9 months, to learn this one work with the thought of conducting it just one time. And that was on the anniversary of my magazine, Institutional Investor. It gave a reason for doing it. It was supposed to be the first and the very last performance I would ever do.
So you hired the hall, you hired the orchestra, and you invited, what, 300 of your closest friends?
Well, more like 3,000.
3,000 of your closest friends. And?
Well, the orchestra set two conditions, that no tickets would be sold to the public and there would be no critics reviewing it. A stipulation, I might add, I was rather pleased with myself. But two critics broke the rules, feeling that they wanted to write about it anyhow, and that's probably the reason I'm sitting here today. They wrote, as they would say in England, rather good reviews. It's quite special. And then I started to receive invitations from around the world to conduct this work, and I've now conducted it in about 40 countries.
And two reviews, which keep you conducting.
I don't want to comment on the quality of my own performances. I think the audience will judge that for themselves, but I can't complain about the critical response.
Well, I think the idea is that the invitations keep coming, and they would not keep coming if it were regularly panned. Michael, you know more about the world of musical criticism than I, but isn't that the case?
That is the case, and I think we probably should stop for a moment and talk about the symphony itself. This is not an early classical or Baroque piece which you can get through by beating time. This is a gigantic piece. Mahler doesn't mess around. As you heard in the very first few bars of the piece, it's an enormous piece. Depending upon the conductor, a performance can last 85 minutes or so or longer. It is a piece with gigantic forces. It's an extremely large orchestra with really supplemented percussion sections. There's a passage with an offstage band. There's a chorus, a large mixed chorus, two soloists. And the score is a particularly treacherous one. It's not just a long score. It's not just a big score. But unlike a piece by Haydn or Mozart, which begins with two instructions from the composer, fast and quiet or slow and loud, Mahler, and we're flipping through the score now, has instructions at virtually every couple of bars. He's got footnotes. He has specific instructions for orchestra placement. He has caveats constantly because in his day, Mahler was probably the most successful conductor, maybe the best-known conductor in the world, and therefore he was smart enough not to trust conductors. So he was always saying, don't do this as well as do that.
But I understand also from my reading that he was not regarded as a composer. He was a great conductor, but they didn't look on him as a composer.
That's right. And for him, in a way, conducting was the bread and butter, and he lived for his summers when he could compose, but he spent an awful lot of time just trying to get performances.
Well, I think his conducting was a fallback position. He had submitted one of his pieces for the Beethoven Prize and lost, and he said that compelled him to the treadmill of conducting. He had to earn a living. But what he brought to his conducting, because today we talk about Mahler the composer, as a conductor, he was unsurpassed. His view was that in every performance, a work had to be reborn. And this sense of renewal in music, what he brought to Vienna, the 10 years that Mahler conducted in Vienna are universally recognized as the golden era of Vienna, never to be obtained again.
So what, in appearance, though, he was a very calm man in demeanor?
Well, not really. He might have been at times, but on the podium he was a madman, and his energy level could bring out forces in the music. People were terrified of him. It was his view, for example, that it wasn't good enough for players simply to do their best. They had to go beyond that to achieve the impossible, and he said, I forced them to do this. So Mahler said, where music is, the demon must be. And this was this fanatical man on the podium. In the summertime, he'd walk in the meadows quietly, but the minute he had that baton in his hand, look out.
Transformation.
He was said to be a cruel man on the podium. There is a selection of reminiscences that was recorded in 1960 for the centennial celebration, published both as a book, I think, by Norman Lebrecht, Reminiscences of Mahler, and the recordings of the interviews are available as well. And some of the players who knew him when he was conducting in New York toward the end of his life spoke about the absolute terror of this man on the podium and his weeding out of dead wood in the orchestra, his demands always for greater and greater climaxes, louder and louder fortissimos. There are many famous stories of him demanding ever louder crashes of the cymbal, crashes of the drum, and finally one exasperated percussionist, I believe, actually broke the membrane, the head of the drum, and Mahler said, finally, we're getting close. That kind of thing.
Well, and as one who has studied him, you did more than study his music, didn't you, Gilbert? You studied the man as well.
I think you can't separate the man from his music, because Mahler himself has said that his music is highly autobiographical. And in a way, each of these symphonies are a chapter in his life. And it's not autobiographical in terms of his experience, but in terms of his emotional makeup. Mahler could write feelings in music more than any other composer. And at the end of the day, my view at least, and the way I approach the conducting of the symphony, is to try to create an emotional architecture which mirrors the musical architecture. And whether this is successful or not depends on not whether you think the music was very pretty or exciting, but does it get under your skin emotionally? And I think that on November 22nd, that will be the test, whether the audience comes in contact with their own emotions through this symphony.
I think when we're talking about emotion and Mahler, we've got to remember that, again, unlike a classical piece, and remember this is a piece written over a period of years, but premiered in 1895, Mahler dealt with the extremes of emotion. It wasn't just happy here, sad there. It was angst-ridden music, and what is a real challenge for the audiences, for the players, and certainly for the conductor, is that oftentimes these conflicting emotions are going on at the very same time. There are passages, many passages, in his Second Symphony and in his other works, even in his songs, where there will be something fairly merry going along in the winds and in the lower strings, something awfully ominous, like a gathering storm. That's something that drove critics crazy. They said this is schizophrenia, this is typical Jewish writing. He dealt with a great deal of anti-Semitism, both as a conductor and as a composer. And I think, Gilbert, you have said in the past that this is part of what makes him so important today.
Well, I think that Mahler always is adopted by each successive decade as their composer. They say he wasn't popular really until the 60s, but since then, Mahler tends to speak for music because his music is so broad, it can embrace all of us. And frankly, at a time when so much contemporary music is lacking in emotional quality, it has other qualities, people are drawn to Mahler and his message, his life, the sheer life of his tale.
Well, let me ask you, do you conduct after Mahler? Are you a demanding man? Can we expect to see the kind of pyrotechnics that he was famed for?
I don't know that you'll see the sort of craziness on the podium that Mahler had, but the answer is that I believe that Mahler knew better than anyone what this piece should sound like. And as Michael was saying earlier, he has more information in the score than any other composer. What to do, what not to do. Don't slow down here. Be careful that you don't play triplets. I follow those directions. But at the end of the day, the most important thing that Mahler said is that what is best in music cannot be found in the notes. This must come from you. You bring your own experience to the podium. And I have been credited with probably coming as close as anyone to getting the detail of the score right. I've studied it an awful lot. But I'd be the first to admit my own performance is very idiosyncratic, is highly personal, and is probably on the emotional side of the spectrum. It may not be to everyone's taste.
We're talking with Gilbert Kaplan and with Michael Shavelson. Gilbert Kaplan will be conducting the Resurrection Symphony by Gustav Mahler at Boston Symphony Hall. Michael Shavelson is a friend of the Boston University World of Ideas and the executive editor of Bostonia and the BU Bridge. Now, Mahler was born a Jew and converted at some point to Catholicism. Do we know whether the conversion was sincere, a necessary step for dealing with the anti-Semitism of his time, which you mentioned earlier, Michael? Is this a Christian resurrection we're talking about, or does it make any difference? Gilbert?
Well, I think Mahler's view toward religion is a subject which is highly debated in the Mahlerian scholarly world. I think there's no question in my mind that he converted from Catholicism to Catholicism in order to obtain the job as the director of the opera. It wasn't that you couldn't be a Jew to have that position. You had to be Catholic. It was to have official government position. There's no doubt in my mind that's what it was. And frankly, Vienna never accepted that conversion. They understood it to be just that, part of a job application. But Mahler was a God-seeker. I don't think he ever believed in organized religion. I think that his idea of resurrection surely is one he wanted to believe in. I myself have always been impressed by the Chinese view of this, which I mentioned because I had the privilege of conducting the premiere of Mahler's Second Symphony in Beijing a few years ago. And the word for resurrection in Chinese is fu huo, which also means self-renewal. And for those who can't identify with the Christian notion or the Jewish notion of resurrection, this is an alternative. As far as Christian resurrection goes, I think that when you see what Mahler did with the words, you understand that he was trying to keep this on a very general level. He used a poetry from an ode, but he rewrote the part of it that had Christ mentioned. Christ is written out of it, and he put in love in place. So this is what complicates the view of Mahler and religion.
And complicates Mahler. I mean, he may be reacting to the changes that he did in his own life, in the conflict that you talked about, Michael.
I think that's true. And at various stages in his life after the conversion, he still referred to himself as a Jew. Maybe it was a racial reference, but certainly to his colleagues and many of the conductors of the day were Jewish. I think he actually said at one point to Oscar Fried, "You and I have a lot in common. We both made the same mistake of having been born Jewish." Hmm. And he referred to himself as I think, Gilbert, you could remember the quotation better than my paraphrase, thrice a stranger.
A Bohemian among Germans, a German among Austrians, and a Jew throughout the world.
Hmm. Well, that gets back to the idea of self-renewal, the idea of change. There's a Canadian author, Robertson Davies, who talks about the twice-born. And you can tell who they are, he said, they often take new names.
Yeah, these names are tricky because although there was a program written for this symphony, as for other symphonies, Mahler really regarded programs and program notes as a crutch. He believed strongly in absolute music. And we are stuck with the title of Resurrection, Auferstehen, which does mean to rise again, or the verb does, to be born again, and the connotation is certainly one in the Christian world. But I have a feeling that Gilbert's got it when he talks about a reaffirmation or a personal rebirth. And certainly it is easy to listen, especially in the last movement, to the apocalypse in the orchestra and to the great calm that leads to the resurrection chorus.
And, of course, the ancient myth of the phoenix that rises from the ashes every 1,000 years. This whole idea has been around since man.
But much as the music can stand on its own, and it certainly does, you don't need to know the program to fall in love and be touched by this music. Mahler did have an idea behind this. He said that he had to write this symphony to answer what, for him, were three burning questions. Why did you live? Why did you suffer? Is life nothing but a huge, frightful joke? And he says that he raises these questions in the first movement and provides the answer in the last, which is resurrection. So he may later have withdrawn this program, but there's no getting away from it. This is what underpins the symphony.
That's remarkable, because in the Austria in which he was living, this was the dark time, nihilism. Nietzsche was the overarching philosopher that people were grabbing onto. So he was really swimming against the tide in any number of ways.
He actually embraced Nietzsche for a while and then rejected him. He used to work and then read Nietzsche to his family in the evening.
And some of Nietzsche's texts find their way into his works, in the Third Symphony in particular.
But he ultimately rejected him for a happier... you're smiling, Michael. Now you're going to have to explain that.
It's awfully hard to know. I don't see him as a nihilist. I think in his student days he was a lot of things. We see that in his musical philosophy as well. He was certainly a great Wagnerian, as were many of his younger student colleagues, but he didn't wholly reject the opposing camp, which was Brahms, nor did he reject the grand old man, Bruckner. Very hard to know, and I think the answer is in the music more than in the biographies, the letters even, and the reminiscences.
And that's really the whole point, because after Nietzsche, Schopenhauer was really the greatest influence on Mahler, because Schopenhauer's view was that music was the only art form that went into you directly without being a representation of something else. A painting was a representation of a building. The music is the representation of nothing except the music. And so that was Mahler's notion, which is why he said, the hell with programs.
And the great thing about music is that, unlike the plastic arts, you can't get your hands on it.
Unless
you're a conductor, of course.
Well, and the musical world of his day rejected his compositions.
For the most part, it...
How did he come to be played? What was the occasion of his...
Mostly, his music was played because he conducted it himself. He conducted it with his own orchestra, but he was also asked to come and play his music. And then there were a handful of people, such as Oscar Fried, such as Willem Mengelberg, the conductor of the Concertgebouw in Holland, was a great champion of his music. And it's often said that Mahler's music did not become popular until Leonard Bernstein brought it to the fore in 1960 on the 100th anniversary of Mahler's birth. It's simply not true. Bernstein gave it a tremendous push, but Mahler's music was played a lot more, played more during his lifetime than is generally realized.
All right, while we're on that, the number of milestones in your career as a conductor. In 1982, you conduct the work in front of an invited audience at the Avery Fisher Hall in Lincoln Center. A year later, you make your public debut at Carnegie Hall. And in 1988, your CD, which we heard, the piece with the London Symphony Orchestra, starts its rise to becoming the number one Mahler-selling recording of all time. In 1996, 40 performances on, you conduct the piece at the Salzburg Festival in Austria. Now that's, what? That's like, what, the World Series in Yankee Stadium? It's like you're walking into the hall where all of this began. Was that your greatest triumph?
It's hard for me to say whether that was my greatest triumph. I've had so many remarkable experiences with each concert. That was regarded by some as the pinnacle one can reach as a conductor, to be invited. I was invited to conduct the opening concert. But I can think of, for example, conducting in China for the first time, the premiere of this symphony to be conducted in the 1990s, to teach Chinese musicians who didn't know Mahler to help a chorus of Chinese singers sing in German, and then to see an audience, half of them in tears. It just shows you that Mahler was right when he said this music comes from some other place and there's no way to escape its power. Here you had an audience who didn't know any program. All they heard was this music wash over them and half of them were in tears. A third of the orchestra was in tears. So I guess triumph, I don't think of music in terms of triumph. For me, it's a love affair, and when those things happen, you have to feel that Mahler knew what he was doing.
But there, of course, was a tremendous symbolic value towards Salzburg. You mentioned Yankee Stadium, although in spite of recent events, I think Fenway Park would have been more apt. But it is a bit like going to the, not just going to Fenway Park or going to the Vatican, but going and saying Mass on your own when it's not your home field. Salzburg is really a temple of music in Austria. And the Austrians believe that they can do it better than anyone else. So here's an American guy who is not really a conductor. He's a conductor of one piece. And I was it Norman Lebrecht who said you're the ultimate specialist who's bringing in an orchestra from England, and he's conducting a performance of this tremendously difficult, overwhelming work, and he should not be able to do it. And there's
So the controversy, tell us about that. What was the...
Well, it really comes from this feeling that the Austrians can do it, and at Salzburg it is such a holy place that only they should be able to do it. There's a marvelous line from the review of the concert from Time magazine, which Michael Walsh wrote. Michael Walsh, who's also on the faculty here at BU. At the end of the performance... Walsh wrote, "Mahler's heaven-storming climaxes shook the Grossfestspielhaus to its granite foundations, and anyone who did not feel a chill at the tremendous peroration must either have been dead or Austrian."
Our guests are Michael Shavelson, whom you just heard, the executive editor of Bostonia and the BU Bridge, and Gilbert Kaplan, who conducts Symphony No. 2 by Gustav Mahler, the Resurrection Symphony, who has taken it and made it his own.
And in many ways, what the critics said after Salzburg, as they've been saying along, I mean, there are certainly critics who simply won't accept the fact that this seems to work, is what a lot of critics said after the release of the record 10 or 12 years ago. And they spoke of a real authenticity, a correctness. Now, naturally, they will gripe at what they want to gripe at. And this is not the perfect, it's not the last Mahler recording. I think as of this week, there have been 88 commercial releases of this piece. But a lot of the critics felt strongly that there was a correctness to this, an authenticity to this, a real reliance on the score.
So you actually, Gilbert, as I understand it, found and purchased the original score with the handwritten notes that Gustav Mahler himself put on it.
Yes, I own his manuscript, and I must say it is a source of inspiration to see the moment when the pen hit the paper. Now, of course, he changed a lot as he went along, and so what we perform today is not precisely what's in that score, but knowing those changes, I think, gives me an insight which other conductors would not have, because if, for example, he changed the color from, say, the flute to the E-flat clarinet, which is a very shrill instrument, if you don't hear that difference, you know that you need to bring that clarinet out a little more. There had to be a reason he made that change. So this is an important part of it. But, of course, I purchased that because I was terrified when it was made available. It would go into someone's vault and we'd never see it again. It's on deposit at the Pierpont Morgan Library in New York, and any qualified scholar can have access to it.
That's not the only thing, though. You're a collector of Mahler memorabilia and music and every photograph ever taken. Is this accurate?
Well, I've published a book called The Mahler Album. I've written this book, which is a complete iconography. It's a pictorial biography of Mahler's life. Yes, and I think that Boston University is going to have an exhibition of these photographs at the same time I'm conducting.
Excellent. Are you trying to send a message with what you're doing, Gilbert?
Well, you know, I'm often given credit for this idea that there is a second act in life, and I wouldn't offer that as a message to anyone. I did feel that the first night I walked out on the stage, though, my very first performance, as nervous as I was, I felt the audience was more nervous. Because in a way, I was a surrogate for them. I was standing on the podium. It wasn't that they wanted to stand on the podium. They wanted to write the book they didn't write. They wanted to get the girl that got away. We all have agendas we haven't fulfilled, and I felt, in a sense, whatever triumph there was at the end of that was a shared one. If I had failed, they would have failed. And I think there's no question that it's one of life's tragedies that we do tend to duck and stop when we think we might be taking a risk to make a fool of ourselves. And I felt that I had two choices at the time. There was two risks, really. One, exactly that, to make a fool of oneself. And the other was to live forever knowing I didn't try. And I could have lived with that first risk. I couldn't live with the second.
So this was never a hobby. You're not a dilettante. But we asked the question before we heard the opening bars of the music. How does the musical world regard you? Do you know? Do you care?
Yes, I know very well by now because it's been, 17 years. I would say that most professional conductors regard me as part of the gang. I know most of them. They would call me a professional of one work. It's interesting because when Carlos Kleiber, a German conductor who many conductors think is the best in the world today, he has a very small repertoire of about 10 works that he conducts. So that's when this journalist that Michael talked about said, I'm the ultimate specialist. There is something that comes out of concentrating. And it's one of the issues between conductors and orchestras today that many orchestras feel conductors do not have enough time to do the kind of work to be prepared. I think that what I bring to this is this combination, which I believe Mahler wanted. One, to completely understand what his intentions are, and then I bring my own life to it as well.
Okay, but there's the term authenticity again. And Michael, how can a conductor approach a composer's original intention, in this case Mahler's? Because we really don't have any recordings of Mahler conducting his own symphony.
That's right. He died just a little bit too early. He died in 1911. There were certainly recordings. There had been since 1876 or so. But he did not record his music, although he did make a few piano rolls of movements and songs, and some of those are available on the Kaplan edition of the Mahler album, as a matter of fact. But I think part of it goes back to Gilbert's earlier comments about the manuscript. Gilbert owns the manuscript, but he doesn't hog it.
No, he's sharing it, huh?
In a couple of ways. I've seen it on display at the Morgan, and it is absolutely thrilling. And he has published a facsimile edition of, I believe, at least the last movement or the entire piece.
The whole symphony, yes.
And having looked at the manuscript and compared it to the published score, there is a lot that occurs to one. One is the corrections that Gilbert mentioned. The other is one passage in particular, and this is something that Gilbert and I talked about recently. It's the beginning of the choral entrance in the last movement. And if you look at the printed score, it's in the last movement at rehearsal 31, and the directions from the conductor are basically, well, they're in German. It's langsam, which is slow, and misterioso, which is Italian for mysteriously. But if you look at the manuscript, which I don't have in my hand, I have only a copy of it, you see that langsam has an exclamation point over it. There's something written before langsam, which has been scratched out, that may have been sehr, extremely misterioso. And the PPP in the score for triple piano, very quiet, is in the manuscript written in letters two or three times larger than anything else. I think here is one way to do it. It's to get as close to the source material as possible. That's something that can't quite translate through the printer. Here it's conducted by one of Mahler's disciples, Otto Klemperer, who conducted this a number of times. This is from a 1951 recording, and the CD is available on a Voxbox set.
The entrance of the chorus in this symphony is an absolutely magical moment. And those directions that Mahler wrote, that Michael was just describing, must be followed. It is the softest entrance in choral music. There is nothing softer. And Mahler also provides information in his letters. And you can find him talking to other conductors about how to bring in this chorus so that it is a mystery and the audience doesn't even know where the chorus is, and it must sound coming from nowhere. We will work very, very hard to achieve this.
Let me ask how you work with an orchestra. How long do you take with each orchestra as you come in and work with them? And what kind of reaction do the players have to you? That's, again, another way of asking how the musical world regards you.
Well, you have as much rehearsal time as you can get. It's as simple as that. Some orchestras that have bigger budgets can afford to give more rehearsal time. So at Boston University, I will do four rehearsals, but they will have some rehearsals with their own conductor prior to my coming to. These are students who will play this piece for the first time. But I must say, some of the most exciting, riveting performances that I have at least been involved with have been with a few student orchestras. And while you cannot expect the kind of polish you can hear, say, from the Boston Symphony, the capacity of students to bring their own excitement and emotions to this may produce something very, very special. And what you do is you go through this very carefully, stopping to try to make the music sound the way it sounds in your head. That's what a conductor does. A conductor has a sound in his head that he wants to reproduce on the stage. And you do anything you can. You sing, you use your body language to bring the sound to the sound you're trying to achieve. And with Mahler, it's very difficult.
In terms of the musical world and its recognition, again, The piece has been conducted almost 40 times by you, Gilbert, and the reactions from the critics range from fine to excellent to unusual. Michael, you would know more about this than I.
I think that's basically true. You may find quibbling here and there. The attack wasn't together. This wasn't happening. Less likely to find criticism of the recording, because the recording was done with a care that is highly unusual in the field, and which involved a strictness to the score that may have been unprecedented. In fact, if there was a criticism, I think it was Donald Mitchell, a great Mahler scholar, who said that maybe there was a little too much fidelity to the notes, and I think he said that Kaplan's now getting better. I think he's getting more comfortable, he's warming, because, of course, we do have the notes here. We have a couple of hundred pages of notes, but it's not just the notes, it's the music. If you listen to the recordings, if you listen to the 88 recordings, which I wouldn't want you to do, you will hear the same notes. And what is interesting, too, we were talking a moment ago about authenticity, is that if you do listen to recordings made, certainly in the first half of the century, by Mahler students or disciples, you will hear the recordings of Fried, of Bruno Walter, of Mengelberg never recorded this. Klemperer recorded the work a number of times. And the funny thing about Klemperer is that he is responsible for the fastest performance on record and for the slowest. It's what you do with those notes.
It's a matter of the conductor using his training, his ear, his good taste. And I think you say, and this is a good quote, the performance can be correct, but it also has to be convincing.
It has to be convincing. It has to be musical. Ideally, there's got to be a sense among the musicians, among the members of the audience, I'd say even of an inevitability. It has got to be this way. It's got to be convincing.
All right. And if this is the largest selling Mahler recording of any Mahler work, you're not selling these out of the back of an SUV, Gilbert. I mean, you don't have a box number where I can write.
I mean, I find it extremely difficult to comment on what others think about my music, but I think that it was probably the New York Times selection of the record when it came out as one of the records of the year that put the recognition in a certain category. And I'm generally given credit for this authenticity issue, but I tell you that I really believe that authenticity in and of itself is really not enough. And that the reason that Mahler said that what is best in music cannot be found in the notes is that what does slow mean, and what does it mean to get louder, and what are the connections? I believe that this piece is basically about feelings. And on November 22nd, I will be concentrating more than anything else on this emotional architecture, because I think that music, if it doesn't touch you, is not interesting and isn't important. And if nothing else, I believe that especially with these young musicians who will be bringing to this music such expectation, because it's a first time, something can happen.
So it's a direct emotional address that you're going to be looking for. And have looked for.
Always is.
Michael, as you look out over the music scene today, what is it that accounts for Mahler's resurgence?
Well, the resurgence has been going on pretty steadily since about 1960, although Gilbert's absolutely right to say that it's false to believe that there was no Mahler between his death and the centennial year. Mahler famously said, my time will come 50 years after my death, and he was a couple of months off. But certainly Bernstein gave it a great big boost. And now, if anything, I would almost say there's too much Mahler around. If you go to the record store, you will see bin after bin after bin of Mahler CDs, most of which are not very good. I think it's probably overprogrammed by the orchestras of the world today because it is so popular. But the reason it's popular is precisely what Gilbert said a little bit earlier on. He's a composer, rather, who deals with real emotionals. He does get under your skin. He deals with conflicting feelings simultaneously. He's very real. He's not dainty. He's oftentimes very rough, very difficult to listen to. And I think he's very much a conductor. I keep doing that. He was a conductor. He's very much a composer of the 20th century. He wrote and worked into the beginning of this century. He really kicked open the door of the 20th century as far as modern tonality is concerned, let's say. One of his students and great admirers was Schoenberg. And I think it was Bernstein who said that Mahler had one foot in the 19th century, one foot in the 20th, but his left foot was in the 19th, and that's where his heart is. So maybe his brain was in the 20th century.
Is his music difficult to play? I mean, as a player, as someone who comes to it as a member of the orchestra, is it difficult music?
It is very difficult, in part because, at least in the symphonies, for the most part, they are long works. They're physically demanding, and as the emperor said, there are a lot of notes.
Well, it's not only that. It's that every note has instructions and character to it, and musicians, by their nature, will not do this. One of the consistent experiences I've had with the best orchestras and the least experienced is that the musicians hold back because they don't want to stick out. They've been trained throughout their life to make a beautiful sound. Some of the sounds Mahler wants are not beautiful. In fact, when he came to Vienna as a conductor, one of the musicians who had been in the Vienna Opera Orchestra said that one of the novelties that Mahler brought was that he really expected us to play everything that was in our parts. You have no idea how novel this was to us. And I think that if you press musicians to deliver on what Mahler has asked, it is extremely challenging. But there is no way, in my view at least, to get the Mahlerian sound, the Mahlerian experience, if you neglect these points of expression in his music. It's what makes Mahler Mahler, and at least it's the underpinning of my performance.
It sounds like it's pushing the envelope at all times.
At all times.
Are you going to, at any subsequent point, move on to another Mahler work or move on to another work?
You know, I didn't learn conducting because I wanted to be a conductor. And in fact, I don't regard myself as part of the profession, even though, as I said earlier, I'm treated that way. For me, the driving force was this symphony. I learned to conduct to express what I felt about this music. I could conduct something else, you know. I would need a reason to do so. As Michael said, there are 88 recordings of Mahler's Second. There are similar numbers for the other ones. We don't need yet another recording. If I felt I had something special to say, I would consider it. And I can't say I haven't conducted anything else. I did conduct at the Hollywood Bowl, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, a few summers ago, and at the last minute I was told I had to conduct the Star Spangled Banner, which I had never conducted, and I panicked because I didn't have the slightest idea how to do it. And the head of the orchestra said, "Oh, you'll love it. Love it. I don't know how to do it." Well, I went to my dressing room in a sweat and looked at it. It's quite easy to conduct. There are only two big decisions: how long you hold those notes. Da 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 da. It's up to the conductor how long that's held. So I went out and I took quite a brisk tempo. And in the review of the concert, the reviewer thought he quibbled with my tempo in the second movement, but he said it was one of the most riveting tempos of the Star Spangled Banner he ever heard.
I've been to enough ball games to know that that piece has probably been butchered by more people than almost anything else, and so I must congratulate you. You get a good critical review on that.
I'd like to do it again.
Don't we credit you as well for the Adagietto from the Fifth?
But this is a bigger subject than we have time for today, I have a feeling. But just the gist of it was that this is probably Mahler's most popular music. It was the soundtrack for Visconti's movie Death in Venice, and it's played only for strings and harp. Bernstein played it at people's funerals all the time, including in Boston, Koussevitzky's funeral. And it was getting slower and slower and more funereal, and research that I and others had done proved that Mahler intended it to be faster. He played it twice as fast as these people were playing it, including Bernstein. And he had written it to send as a love letter to Alma Schindler as a letter of proposal. In other words, it was a love letter, a love song without words. And if you think of it as a love song, it has to flow. So I have conducted that one movement. There's a recording of it, because I feel that one has to help Mahler in these moments when there are differences between the way he wanted things played and the way they're being played. So in that sense, I think he cared a lot. He was quite flexible, but really on matters of tempo, he felt that his tempo should be followed.
And so it was to, if you will, resurrect this piece from misuse that you studied it and conducted it.
Yes, and I made a big effort to inform conductors about it because I felt these were not my ideas. I was not shy about this, and I do think it's had some effect on the way the music is played today because most conductors, when they're informed of what Mahler really wanted, of course want to follow it. So you find this adagietto played much more lyrically, and you don't find these sluggish tempos which make you think it's meant to be played at a funeral.
Comment, Michael?
Well, Gilbert is very good about providing the evidence. You can buy the other 87 other records, hear what the conductor has to say, and that's that. But one of the interesting points about Gilbert's Mahler record is that it comes with a tremendous amount of backup material, an explanation of why Gilbert is doing this in a different way, why he's doing that in a way that seems a little bit unusual. And I think the current edition of the Mahler Second even comes with a miniature facsimile of the score, but unlike the OED, it doesn't come with a magnifying glass. But Gilbert does try to come up with his evidence, his reason for doing these things. It's not just a matter of saying, I feel that the clarinets have to come out here. And although that may be a perfectly good reason, especially in the music of somebody so emotional as Mahler, but generally speaking, Gilbert wants us to know why he's taking a certain route, especially if it's a route less traveled.
And in a way, you know, this was a necessity at the beginning. You asked about the response of musicians to my conducting. I'm mostly invited by orchestral committees, so they have done their homework and decide that I can do what they want me to do. But I often get into disagreements with them about tradition. Mahler said that, you know, tradition is slovenliness, and Toscanini said that tradition is the last bad performance. But musicians get comfortable with things which simply aren't right, and the perfect example would be the opening note of the symphony. It's always played with a big attack, and yet, when I ask the musicians to play it with just a fast bow to bring an attack, but not a hard hit, they say, but we've always done it the other way. And I said, but there is no accent on that note. And they look at their parts, which they haven't studied carefully, and they discover, my goodness, there is no accent there. After that, there are no more debates.
Well, isn't that the role of the conductor, to end debate?
Well, it depends upon the orchestra. But yes, the conductor has to have a vision. And he's got to know, when he steps up for the first downbeat, where he's going. And I mean that quite literally. One of the great things about Toscanini, who, so far as I know, had no interest in Mahler, the man or the person, I think he referred to the man whom he knew in New York as that crazy man, when he got up to the podium and began a piece, he knew that he was heading for that last bar. There was an almost plastic line from the beginning of the piece to the end. So yes, absolutely, the conductor has to know where he's taking this train.
So we've almost come full circle here. We've spoken of Mahler's passion when conducting. You mentioned that Toscanini acted like a crazy man. Let me ask you, Gilbert. Somebody somewhere must have used the word obsession in describing what you're doing. How do you respond to that?
Gilbert usually says, thank you.
Now, I prefer a different term. I prefer to call it a love affair. A love affair which, by the way, my wife understands. I think an obsession carries connotations which don't go far enough, you see. I think this is a matter of love, and my connection with the music is what empowers me to do what I'm not supposed to be able to do. And there's no other explanation for it. It is in the area of the unanswerable. The only sort of technical thing I understand about the impossible was told to me by an engineer who said that if you look at the bumblebee and you look at its weight, its wingspan, its strength, technically, aeronautically, the bumblebee is incapable of flying. But you see, the bumblebee doesn't know that, so it goes on flying anyhow.
You've been listening to a Boston University World of Ideas conversation and talk on Conducting the Resurrection. Our guests have been former publisher and now Mahler Resurrection Symphony conductor, Gilbert Kaplan, and Bostonia Magazine's executive editor, Michael Shavelson. Join us again next week. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. Visit our website at wbur.org and wrni.org. Our webmaster is Angel Caselli. Tonight's program was produced by Glenn Alexander and Bob Zalisk. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Sophos Antivirus, protecting corporate networks worldwide for over 10 years, offering career opportunities to skilled technical support, marketing, and sales professionals. SOPHOS.com. By Gentle Giant Moving and Storage Company, orchestrating moves around the block or around the world. Winner of Boston Magazine's The Best of Boston Award for 5 years in a row. In the forecast for tonight, partly cloudy with patchy fog, chance of showers or thunderstorms developing right through the overnight with lows in the 50s. Tomorrow, the Memorial Day holiday, mostly cloudy with showers and thunderstorms likely, highs in the 70s. For tomorrow night, partly cloudy with lows in the 50s. Tuesday, mostly sunny with a chance of showers in the afternoon, highs in the low 70s. And the outlook for Wednesday, partly cloudy with highs in the 60s. Right now, it's 56 degrees in Boston. It's 61 in Chatham and 61 in Hyannis. And we're looking at 58 degrees in Providence. Stay tuned. Coming up at 10 o'clock after the news, it's BBC Assignment. This is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence.